Hey folks, welcome to another exciting episode of Long Shots. Hey Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very well, and I'm really looking forward to today's chat as well.
Dude, the objective always of these conversations is to look forward to
I agree, them. I
we
agree.
Always make sure to have people who we look forward to talking to, right?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to listening to it after as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so joining us remotely, straight from Mumbai, is Abhijit Awasthi. Hey Abhijit, how's it going?
It's fine, it's going good. Thanks for asking.
Great, no, thanks a lot for finding the time. Abhijit works for an investment bank. I worked for an investment bank for 5 years. Sharad, you also worked for a bank. So, yeah, three bankers on a podcast. Not very unpredictable, is it?
Yeah, hopefully the conversation lives up to the billing.
Yeah, absolutely. So Abhijit and I kind of had a very chance, I would say, interaction.
Yeah.
I think it's been more than like more than half a year now.
Okay.
When a common friend introduced me to his daily email, which he sends to, I think, his clients. He sends also to a lot of other people. So in which he kind of gives his take on the global markets. But what was very interesting was that it was not a very formal, you know, typical internal bank update kind of an email.
Yeah.
It had a lot of structure. It had a lot of nuance. And, you know, he would put in pop culture references and historical references and try to link it to core financial and markets related topics.
Yeah.
And that's how we kind of, you know, came into touch.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he's like from a formal professional investment banking background, but it's the content end of Abhijit which really, I think, struck a chord with me.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I'm really excited to hear your thoughts and how that came into existence. And no, really appreciate you taking the time out, Abhijit. Thank you so much for coming in. And it's good to be introduced as well. Nikhil has been telling me about this content play of yours. And so it's good to finally have a face to the name.
Thanks, thanks, Sharad. Thanks, Nikhil. Thanks for a very glowing introduction. So as you told, that we got introduced and we were introduced to each other's content. Then I'll basically talk about what I write. I write a daily global markets commentary for my clients.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started it, so I'll just give you a background of how it got started and why it got into a form in which it is and what is the pros and cons of being in that format. So if you see all around us, we are right now living in an age where there's an information deluge. All of us are like bombarded with bits of information, either it's from news channels, either it's from your WhatsApp updates. So from every possible channel, we are getting loads of data. And there's no dearth of information for all of us. So when I started some two and a half years ago, I decided that I need to send out an email with global markets commentary to my clients. I thought long and hard about it, that what would make it different. There's no point in adding to the same deluge if I'm writing that, okay, Dow Jones went up last night, there's a possible bond auction today in India, and all those things are already in the public domain.
Yeah.
There's no need for me to add to the clutter.
Correct, yeah.
So I thought long and hard about it and thought that what else I can do. And also at the same time, because this email was supposed to go from a bank's email ID, so you have to respect that you can't be all over the place.
Yeah.
So there has to be a balance which has to come in. But at the same time, you need to break the depth. So pretty long when I was doing my MBA, so one of my marketing prof had given me a single line dictum that give me differentiation or give me death. So if your product is not differentiated, there's no need to wait in the for it to be in the market. There are already good and better products there. You have to create your own niche.
Yeah.
So then I thought that rather than giving a plain and simple update, let's give it a twist. So there would be a content which would be related to the global market happening, which is going on, which is recent. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I tried that I would give that content some background of philosophy, some background of history, some background of my own understanding of things. And one thing which the reader would feel after reading that content would, okay, I have learned something new.
Mm-hmm.
It may be of use, it may not be of use, immediate use. Maybe you cannot make a trade out of it. That whether you need to short euro, you need to go long euro, maybe you're not able to tell it by reading my email, but at least I'll give you a historical and philosophical background of the same. So I started it started pretty humbly. It used to go to my very small set of clients, and slowly and slowly over time, as we are fond of saying organically, the mail list increased, and to my amusement and my surprise, after some time, I started getting a lot of feedback from the client.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that, okay, we already have maybe 50 other emails from similar banks which cover the daily market updates. But we have a special time for your content because it's different. And maybe we don't read it right at the morning when you send it out. We keep it like a leisure type
yeah.
of reading.
Yeah.
So that was very heartening for me. And then I started and I tried to refine it. And one thing which I realized, that if you do a certain thing with perseverance, that because this mail goes out daily and I am the author, I do the research, I do the context searching and all, everything.
Mm-hmm.
So after a time what happens that the clients also recognize that there is a guy who is taking a lot of effort in writing these, and they, apart from liking their content, they start appreciating that fact also, that it is happening on a very, very regular basis. It's happening right. on a daily basis. So it becomes a natural habit, okay, every day when you open your inbox, okay, email from Mr. XYZ is there.
Yeah.
You may not open it, you may open it, but that sort of consistency also works.
Yeah.
So two things helped me over there. So one was obviously the content was a bit different and it was a bit like something which was not seen,
mm-hmm.
at least in the global market updates which the client get, and the consistency of it.
Yeah.
So these things, and I would say that even Nikhil, when you receive it on a daily basis, you would not be reading it on a maybe daily, but once in a while you would see that, okay, that today's topic looks a bit interesting. Let me open it and read it. What is this?
No, there's definitely like a very regular novelty factor, you know, which comes into your emails, because every time you open it, I mean, I think, and that's your objective as well, that there is something non-conventional which is usually, you know, used as some sort of a reference. And that kind of attracts me personally. But, you know, I mean, I just want to kind of, you know, step back for a moment. Like let's face it, like you kind of are looking at, you know, customer engagement for global markets division in first round. You are kind of, you know, advising currency and interest rate trades. Now, that's a very formal, rigid kind of a environment, right? And I mean, we have kind of come from financial services backgrounds, and there, you know, like there are always two ways of look at things, right? I mean, is it something which is good to have, or is it something which is need to have? And typically the balance used to tilt towards the latter rather than for the former. And like, you know, a product like yours, an email like yours, I think sits somewhere in between. You yourself said that it's not like you're always giving some information which can be traded upon. So how was it like internally for you? Like, how were you able to, you know, was there some resistance internally that I want to write an email in this structure because it was so unconventional? Or was there always, you know, support you got internally as well?
Because I gave them that, okay, this is the kind which I would like to write. Obviously, right at the onset, it was not clear how it would basically grow, in what form it would grow into. But there are some areas which are no-go.
Right.
Coming from a bank, you can't behave like a freelance blogger.
Right.
So there are certain areas, there are certain topics which are in no-go territory.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to respect that, and you have to appreciate the fact that if you are using a bank's platform,
mm-hmm.
you need to be within those limits. This was my approach, and that's why even my bosses in my organization, they sort of agreed to it, okay, let's try this. And when they saw the results that, okay, the kind of reception which these emails are getting are good enough, am the content writer, so the check and the, what do you say, the blame lies with me. If I write something and it goes out, it can create issues.
Yeah.
So I have to be very, 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 very cautious of what kind of topic do I choose for it. So if, what do you say, the political territory is a no-go.
Yeah.
And that is understandable, because in India where we live in, there are content which can cause some kind of concern for some group of people, which you don't even know and which is not even the intention while writing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So at the very basic, I make this check when I write that I'm not even remotely touching something which is controversial.
Yeah.
So that is my intention.
You know, one of the most important things about sending a regular daily piece, much like the one that you send, is like the philosophy that you internally use to identify what is important, or the philosophy behind curation. How do you typically go about it? How do you, you know, is it more about just the biggest movers? And obviously, there's a time-sensitive element, especially in the world of macroeconomics and FX. Or are you, you know, trying to back-solve into what is more interesting and what can garner more readership? Or is it just a function of, you know, I don't know if it's going to be stale or boring, but it's the biggest, most important piece of news that's coming out, so it's got to be touched. How do you go about identifying your topic or thesis for the day?
What I really believe is that markets are a very interesting animal.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of topics which we can touch upon. So there are set of topics which it helps that I read a lot. I read a lot about market history. I need to read a lot about economics. I read a lot about behavioral finance and all those things. So there is an element of all these things which come in. So let's say, I'll give an example. Let's say you see that there is a risk off in the today's trade. You see all the equity markets are going down. All the emerging market currencies are going down.
Yeah.
And there's suddenly a paranoia which has gripped the entire market.
Right.
So this is the right time, this is the right way to write about risk.
Yeah.
And this is the right, and then you can take a step back and tell your client that what exactly is risk, why and how the risk as a human being, why we are the most alert when we are faced with the risk.
Yeah.
What? So then you talk about the evolutionary history of Homo sapiens, which comes in the books of Hariri and Taleb. When you are faced with a danger, suddenly your antennas are up. So, and why that happened? So then you will put in an anecdote about why the early human being, early Homo sapiens, who used to go into hostile territory, they used to be alert about each and everything. A hustle in the bush can be a snake, cannot be a snake.
Right.
But you can't take chances.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we are so risk averse, that's why we are so cautious when we are faced with something which is threatening.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of story which I would bring in.
Correct.
Let's say another example. There is a day when suddenly dollar demand all over the world is going up.
Mm-hmm.
So then that is the day when you talk about why dollar is the reserve currency of the world. So then you go back.
Historical perspective.
Give them a historical perspective. Okay, what happened in World War One? What happened in World War Two? Okay, World War Two, all the countries were basically annihilated, and only the US was standing. Then they did a treaty, then Bretton Woods happened. So the point is that there are so many topics and so many interesting things which can give you historical, philosophical perspective and make your reading of the today's news much more enriching. There's no point in just knowing that dollar is going up, dollar is going down.
Yeah.
Unless until you are also convinced and you are also aware of why dollar is so special, why US is so special.
Mm-hmm.
But then someday you can take up the topic about US and China. Okay. So why suddenly from where China has come up? What happened? Where was the world 30 years back? It was a bipolar world between China, not China and US, but between US and Russia. So there were some treaties in place which were to take into account this bipolarity.
Right.
And suddenly that one pole has gone.
Yeah.
The USSR just imploded. The whole communist regime just imploded. So the point that I make is that with everyday news, there is, if you have economic merit test, there is an interesting story which can be woven around it.
Yeah.
No. And thankfully, I'm able to find it on a day-to-day basis. And the basic mantra of doing it is to read a lot, to read extensively, exhaustively, whatever you can get your hands on, just read it, and then probably try to apply it.
Yeah.
And frankly speaking, sometimes you hit the bullseye and sometimes you have a misfire. And yeah. That also happens. Maybe sometimes my references just don't gel.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That day I get a feedback also, okay, Abhijit, this was just over the top.
Yeah.
So that is the game of, that's yeah. How the game is.
That's fascinating, and you know, like you obviously have you know, work at a big bank, and you obviously have institutional setup like that. But as a reader as well, since you read a lot, and you know, what do you think is how do you see content like as a customer acquisition tool, or do you see that, you know, in terms of broader financial services business, do you see it as, you know, a value? What kind of value add that content, just pure content, can bring in, like in today's world, like you said, right? It's just, there's so much of content out there, like global markets, there'll be like, you know, so many pieces out there every day, every minute. So how do you sort of view content as a customer acquisition tool or a churn mitigant, or generally what role you think it'll play in businesses?
So that's a very, very, very valid question which you have, Sharad. Because ultimately what my goal is, if I'm writing out an email, this is not out of my own love for writing emails, that I'm ultimately has to lead to something. It has to lead to some newer acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And now you see that whole setup, the whole society, the whole ecosystem, the financial ecosystem, the corporates with whom I am interacting, everyone has become smart. Unless they offer them something which is different, which is for which they are going to remember you, there's no point. Because if there is like there is nothing which I can give extra. Okay, I am in, I'll just give a background of, I am a currency dealer. So currency dealer can ultimately give you what is the interbank rate. Beyond interbank rate, which is the rate at which the currency is dealing right now, I can't make you an improvement over there. So, and right now, because of the information availability, the ease of information availability, all the banks are doing the same. So beyond that point, how do you sell yourself? How do you sell the bank? How do you sell yourself as a currency advisor, interest rate advisor, currency dealer? How do you do that? So you have to create a niche for yourself. So this is what this content is creating. At least when someone reads it, he remembers it. Okay, I read it and I liked it. Okay, now we need, let's go and talk. So this is my idea of preparing a base for myself, so that whenever I would call that client and I would give reference, have you read that? I sent you this mailer today about this, talking about this. Have you read that? So the interest factor is, I would say, many folds. And then getting that customer into my setup is much more easier. If I'm just, I'm out of 80 banks, I'm one bank, and I'm selling the same stuff, what is the distinction, what is the differentiation which I'm bringing? Nothing. So why would a corporate customer which is already doing business with five other banks would include me? There's no reason, no rhyme and reason for them. You have to create some interesting factor about it. Mm-hmm. So that is my whole idea, and that is what my whole energy goes into, that ultimately this mail should lead into that.
So like this kind of becomes a very interesting conversational element, right, in most cases with your clients. And I mean, but you know, I mean, obviously you have existing clients, but I'm sure your email is now going to a lot of new people. Like, I mean, for instance, like myself, right? I mean, I'm assuming there are a lot of people in the industry, outside the industry, it goes out to. Over time, how has the overall endpoint evolved, in the sense that in the beginning, I'm sure when you were sending the mailer, it was initial stages, you were also probably refining the content layout, you were also kind of, you know, refining the product, but there's a moment when it goes into auto mode, right? And there's a moment when you actually start seeing some sort of tangible benefit out of it, either through feedback or through some sort of an interesting client conversation. So how long did this process actually stretch for you since you started this?
Nikhil, as I said in the start, that there are two things which are very important in this. One, obviously, the differentiating element was there, and then the persistence of sending it on a daily basis and sending it, sending something unique on a daily basis. So that has really worked. And I would say that we sometimes don't value the importance of serendipity in our daily life. So these kind of email stuff and the kind of work which you are doing, which is reaching a wider public beyond what you have imagined, maybe as you people post your stuff on LinkedIn, you don't know who all are interacting with it, who all are referring to it, who all are finding it interesting, all those. So there's an element of serendipity here. So now after doing this work for 2.5 years on a continuous basis, I find that maybe that particular client has not read it on that day, but he referred it to someone else, then right. That referred it to someone else. So I would quote here one of my very favorite authors, Mr. Arun Shori.
Mm-hmm.
So he is a very prolific writer. So he said that for the writers or for the content creators like you, not exactly pointing to me, but he was saying it in general, it is very important to write it and then send it into the cosmos. Then the content would find its own readers. And maybe it is something even which you would not have realized, okay. And then this whole play of serendipity would play out.
Right.
That you, the point is I'm essentially making that you can't be very specific. Okay, I have written this today. I want a result tomorrow. I have sent it to Mr. X. I want business from Mr. X tomorrow. That is not how it's going to work.
Yeah.
You are in the field where it is very cluttered. You are in the field where it is, the competition is huge. You have to be at it on a very, very, very regular basis, and then someday the magic would happen.
Yeah.
So this is what my philosophy is, and that is what keeps me going.
But I mean, this, it's very interesting you say that. I mean, you kind of focus a lot on text content, right? It's 100% text content. And I get it. Obviously, you can't, I mean, in the industry where you are, there are people who do open their emails. There are people who actually look at, you know, text content fairly seriously. But I mean, like, if you like take a step back into the content universe in general, there's like so much commentary on, you know, how video or audio or shorter, snappier bits, you know, how attention spans are going down. Like you keep on hearing that, you know, the average person's attention span is like less than 3 seconds. And, you know, we live in the age of Instagram and Snapchat. Me and Sharad often strongly feel that, you know, come what may, the written word is where the magic actually starts. Everything else is then a game of formats, you know, like even a great movie starts with a screenplay. I mean, what are your kind of, observations on that aspect, you know, on the dynamic of format?
I would completely take the point that the format is important, and given the attention span of people is reducing by day, so it is important to say your whatever you want to say quickly and in the most simple manner. So this is what, but as I said earlier, that I am guided by the format or the framework of the bands which I am working with. So that has to, we have to take and appreciate that.
Of course, of course.
I would have loved to do it in a much more interesting and a snappier way, but given that this is going on a daily basis, so daily basis, creating that content would also involve a lot of basically involvement of resources, which I don't have at my disposal. But at the same time, again, I'll come back to the same thing, that you don't know what your audience is looking for right at the start. But at some point of time, there are people who would be hooked on to your kind of stuff. That what I realized, that the my readers, so if let's say my mailer goes out to 1,000 people, it is very well possible that 500 don't even take the pain of opening it up. Maybe around 250 open it up and read it on a daily basis. But only 50 to 100 are the The amount of effort which takes me for writing an email is say for 100,000 or maybe let's say 20,000 also.
Right.
So my so the hit ratio or the percentage will always remain the same. That's what I have seen. When it used to go to a very smaller audience, a very smaller percentage used to give me the feedback. When it started going to a very long list, the proportion of the people who interact with you remained the same. So the point being that ultimately your content will find its own readers, and they will be the ones who with whom you will be able to have a longer engagement or a more fruitful engagement, so to say.
Right.
No, that's very interesting, and you know, I just can't help but we're talking so much about content, but I'm intrigued, and I think I really want to touch a little bit on your views on global markets, since you've got a first-hand view on it. How are you reading the markets? And I mean, we're obviously a little ahead from the lows that we saw in March, and there's been some rally in the emerging markets as well. How are you, as of now, looking at the markets? And it's a tough one to even read properly right now, but what are your high-level views?
Yeah. The markets, basically taking care of dollar rupee, euro, yen. And in currency markets, what happens is that the distinction is very clear. There are set of currencies where the flow is very controlled.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say for India. In India also, the central bank intervention into the currency market is very, very pronounced. So, some days, they will decide that market has to remain in a particular range.
Right.
So in that, in those periods, it will not cross even 20 paisa movements on either side. And at the same time, there are currencies, there are jurisdictions where it is allowed a free flow of information and free flow of in and out kind of movement is allowed. Say for example, let's say South African rand. South African rand, they say that the central bank will not intervene in the market. So the movements in the currency are very pronounced.
Yeah.
On the other side, then you'll see the Chinese yuan. Chinese yuan is a tightly controlled currency.
Right.
So what happens is that in some currencies, we see a very pronounced movement. Let's say for US dollars. It happens to be the reserve currency of the world. What we see is that whenever there is kind of a risk-off scenario. So everyone would flock into US dollars. All the emerging market currencies would start going down.
Like a flight to quality, I guess.
In US, is that a lot of factors which are coming in together and making it a bit fragile. One mm-hmm. is obviously the way they have handled their pandemic situation has not been good.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to open it very soon when they were not ready, and suddenly they have seen that the daily cases are in excess of 60,000. Similarly, if you see in Euro, the way they have handled the pandemic situation has been great. That is obviously because the population is less, and the implementation of their programs has also been good. So we are in the current scenario, we are seeing a clear distinction between dollar and euro. And you have seen that euro has raised from 1.13 a month back to 1.19 now. So this is what I see is that for considerable stretch of time, this euro outperformance against dollar would be staying. Dollar would have some definitive results or definitive leads emerging on the presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So presidential election is in November. Suddenly we are seeing a lot of human cry being made about what Trump wants, what he wants to delay the election. So till that time, till that uncertainty is out of the window, dollar would remain weak. Euro, Japanese yen, Swiss franc, these kind of currencies would strengthen.
Mm-hmm.
Indian currency, what I would see, I'm not allowed to give a house view or directional view, but I would say that it could remain in a range, and the risk if there are risks on the downside of it, because you see India is still not out of this pandemic situation. Fiscally we are not doing good. all the economic contraction which were earlier forecasted, the fear is that it is going to be much more pronounced than that. So in India, we are sitting with I would go with a depreciation bias on the dollar and the euro. I would see a euro outperforming dollar for a considerable period of time.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether this answers your question, but
this is
the speech which I make to my clients on a very daily basis.
This is helpful. Nikhil and I have discussions around these. I mean, we both follow sort of markets as well.
I'm very interested in knowing more of his views on the US macro, you know, because, I mean, like, you know, the impression that like we had, especially in India, was that US or the Fed has dealt with COVID from an economic standpoint in a much more superior manner than a US public policy has managed to fix the healthcare end of things, in the sense that, you know, their Fed has kind of opened up its war chest in a very significant manner. It's providing direct support, you know, it's directly buying corporate bonds, whereas in India we are looking at, and the RBI still going through the banking system. Do you have any bias towards which side is probably a better approach to take?
So, you correctly said that the way Fed moved and supported the market was very, very reassuring for the market.
Yeah.
You saw that how the equity markets in the US rebounded. But now there is a limit to the Fed action, if you see.
Yeah.
Ultimately, if you see this week's Fed announcement, that they are going to continue with this policy of zero interest rate and easy liquidity for some time. So, but now what happens, market is not trading on the news which is coming in right now. It is trading or the news which is going to happen. So, the easy liquidity regime, the zero interest rate has already been discounted. So, now what next? So, that's what happened when you see a European response like the PPP program or the Eurowide fund for supporting the distressed economy. So the market was surprised there. But how come these guys, which were such a fragmented unit so far, has come together and held their currency?
Right.
So the surprise moves to the market, not the news which has already been discounted. So the Fed, that Fed would come in and they would give support to all the country has already been discounted. Now, the next, obviously, you people would also be tracking is how the US Senate is moving on the next phase of the relief package. So, whether it's going to be $1 trillion, whether it's going to be $3 trillion. So, the market would move on the basis of that, how that news pans out.
Right.
Yeah.
But, like, how do you read the response back home, you know, in terms of RBI? I mean, what's your take on that? In the beginning, when everybody was waiting for a fiscal stimulus, RBI obviously was much more proactive. It came out with a clear guidance.
Yeah.
It came out with some sort of a plan in terms of TLTROs. But, you know, over time, I mean, at least our realization has been that, you know, barring the top 20 or 30 corporates and financial institutions, the RBI support probably hasn't trickled down to the grassroots level because it is indirect from a structural standpoint. What do you think about that?
So yeah, fair point. If you compare the Fed with what RBI has done, Fed has been much more direct. RBI has been much more indirect. They are dependent upon the banks to carry out their program.
Right.
And what happens is that you need to take all these indirect programs with a pinch of salt. Ultimately, if you are saying that I won't lend directly, but I want you to lend and I would give you some kind of regulatory forbearance in the future. Institutions don't make that choice. There's an individual who is supposed to make that choice, who's supposed to write or approve that loan and all. And propensity to take on risk at an individual level can be much, much lesser. Maybe there's an overall need for giving a very, very elaborate relief program to MSMEs and with these small businesses. But the individual who is going to approve those loans is sitting with a the memory that what happened some 8-9 years back when he was supposed, he was told to go easy on some loans, and then it came back to bite him.
Yeah.
So in that ambit, I would not expand on that argument, because then we would move into some controversial territory. So I would not do that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you want someone someone else to do your job, there is a huge probability that it won't get done.
Yeah.
This is what my reading of RBI has been. Vis-a-vis Fed, Fed moved into the markets themselves. They started buying the corporate bonds themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But here in India, we took a different approach. Maybe that's good, bad, ugly, I don't know. Maybe the results of it would be visible down the some years down the line. But I would, at my personal level, I would feel that this approach doesn't work.
Yeah, and listen, yeah, I mean, we are on the same page broadly, and we wrote a bit on it as well a while back in terms of, you know, the initial support through TLTROs to sort of de-stress the credit markets were fairly okay. But after that, the whole stimulus angle seemed, like you said, very, very indirect. And, you know, in our view, it sort of lacked the exact motivation as well. But, you know, what do you think is the way forward in terms of, like, NPAs probably will go up sequentially as well. I mean, these loan holidays and things like that will eventually have to be accounted for. You know, Nikhil...
August is a sweet spot, right?
Yeah. And Nikhil, and we talk extensively about it. Nikhil sort of used to cover the, you know, the FIG sector as well. So we internally discuss and debate a lot, but it, you know, the sense is that those numbers, this uptick in NPS will come and hurt, right? I mean, it's not just going to go away. It will have to come back. That is a big overhang. Should it be? Or, like, do you think the markets are even factoring that kind of risk today?
On the equity market side, I guess there is some realization that the party might be getting over sometime.
Yeah.
And you correctly said that NPS, ultimately, the bank... working in a bank, and you people also have worked in a bank, it is very important to realize that any bank which is making out loans has to be properly capitalized.
Yeah,
right.
I don't see that in India, many banks, especially in the public sector, are capitalized enough to carry out the kind of loan making which they want to do or which the government wants them to do. So they are not capitalized enough. And the private sector banks are not going to make those kind of risky bets.
Yeah.
And they are always going to be very, very sensitive towards what their shareholders want.
Yeah, yeah.
So ultimately, this whole NPA thing, that is the secondary question. But ultimately, whether you are able to make those loans right now or not, that also is important. Because if you don't make those loans right now, then the economy is not going to restart.
Yeah.
In US, what's happening that they are giving direct relief to the small guy. That's why they can even hope that my recovery pattern would be a V-shape or a W-shape or whatever.
Yeah.
In India, we are not even in the first stage. If you don't help the people who are in need, how can you be sure that they will come back after a period of time?
Yeah.
Maybe they are gone. They are just structurally gone. So that is my reading of it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the NPA, the legacy NPA which are there, or the legacy loans which are there, they might turn good, bad, we don't know. But I don't think so, in my personal reading, that we are, as a banking sector, we are ready to or capitalize enough to face that.
No, I mean, Abhijit, like, since you mentioned you are somewhat of a student of history, and you obviously enjoy reading about economic theories. And you obviously, during our conversation on NPAs, you mentioned how would the economy restart. I mean, are you like a Keynesianian who thinks that it's going to be fiscal expansion which will save the day? You know, the government just needs to borrow more and spend on infra, spend on utilities, and not like wait for the private sector to recover on its own, because that's not going to happen. Or you are going to, like, you know, allow, or you're of the frame of mind where, you know, you let the markets find their own way. You know, that magical hand of markets should take back control. Where do you stand?
So, on that front, I'm a bit Keynesian.
I thought so.
And my approach towards market. Because markets, what I believe is that they are not created in vacuum. There has to be a guiding hand to them. There has to be a hand which supports
which is not
them
invisible.
In their initial phase and in their whenever they are in under stress. So so whenever the problem is system wide, whenever the problem is so acute that no private guy can come in and start and restart. So there's going to be a problem. Because if you see, I as a private investor or as a private entrepreneur, I will value my capital, the risk capital, to my dear life. Unless until I'm sure of the returns. And frankly speaking, any entrepreneur would get into any kind of business only when he sees super normal profits. The normal profit he can get in by investing in some equities also. But when he sees that there are some super normal profits to be made, then only he will come in and he will invest his own hard money, hard capital into it. But that's not the case with the government. Government at the very onset don't need to care about these things. They need, as the Keynesian theory goes, that in the times of distress, you just go and spend. Maybe that will generate that virtuous cycle where everyone feels, okay, the things are good, let me go out and spend.
Yeah.
Right now, as a consumer also, when I'm not very sure about my own job or how my own company is going to perform, I'm not going to spend. When I'm not going to spend, the whole cycle is going to stop.
You know what, you should, probably, you know, if you lived in Delhi, you would not be insulated from that point of view for long. I mean, here it's so common if you go to summits, you know, where bureaucrats or politicians, like one of the first war cries they make is that, you know, why don't you set up this industry? Why don't you set up that industry? Why don't you, you know, get into this particular activity? But like what I think a lot of the polity kind of fails to understand is that entrepreneurship is by definition a very risky activity. I mean, even like, I mean, as entrepreneurs ourselves, I mean, before we started what we are doing right now, we must have like, you know, shortlisted 30 or 35 plus ideas, eliminating most of them, because when it comes to actually implementing it yourself, you know, where you are actually putting your hard-earned savings or your time as an investment, that's when you realize that, you know, I mean, these are not things which are being done for the sake of a quote-unquote mission.
What happened, like government says, okay, now this area or this part of the country has been, is now free of terrorism, free of nixilism. Why don't the private industry come in and
set up shop?
No, nothing. No, that, those kind of things don't happen by making a rule or pronouncing an order.
Yeah.
The private industry would come in where they see super normal profits to be made.
Right.
And they see that, okay, this can go on and this is the kind of return which I will make. Unless until they see that visibility, they have that visibility, nothing would happen. So that's why in times of crisis, the Keynesian approach works.
Right.
But sadly, and sorry to say, the nation or the government also needs to have the finances to carry out the Keynesian approach.
Yeah.
Which sadly we don't have.
Yeah.
The kind of stretched finances which we have. And that's why I think that government is going slow, because they know the limits of their intervention.
Right.
The
right.
same thing is not happening in US, because they are the world's reserve currency. They can print dollars and they can invest.
Right.
Similar thing won't happen in India. If we start to indulge, we start to spend beyond our means, suddenly the bond markets would turn against us. Suddenly the foreign investors would start becoming jittery of the government finances, and suddenly the borrowing cost for the government would go up. So we are not in the same boat as US. We are not US. We should not dream of also becoming US. We have our own constraints. But within the constraints, government has to take the lead. That's why that's what my argument would end.
Yeah. No. That's. I think pretty much in line with a lot of our house thinking as well. It was
we do have a house view, you know. We share only on our podcast. Nothing more
and write about it as well.
As we are talking now about, you know, the different approaches, so I keep reading about all these interesting books and on economic history and economics. So what essentially comes out is that there is no one-size-fits-all economic theory which would work. Economics is not physics.
Yeah.
Physics is like, okay, E is equal to mc square is going to remain E framework. But in economics, it is not necessarily the trick which you used in Germany is going to work in India.
Absolutely.
The trick which you used in Ghana is going to work in India.
Yeah.
So it is a different animal everywhere, and that's why it is not a hard science, and that's why all of us having read economics have two views about each and everything. Okay, and one more thing is that all the things, and being a person from the markets and trading currency day in and day out, everything is so clear, crystal clear in hindsight that you know, okay, oh, this was should have been done. But when you are supposed to make a policy, when you are supposed to do something and which is the result lies in future, it is so damn difficult. But the moment that thing passes, you will be sure, okay, damn sure, okay, this is how it was supposed to be done. It is a tough job for the policy makers, I must say. But at the same time, my two bits, and as you agree, would be that government needs to come in.
Yeah, no, completely agree. I mean, every behavioral economics book you'll read will have a dedicated chapter on hindsight bias, right? I mean, it's there for a reason. So we obviously see that immensely at play.
I mean, no, I mean, on
that's very close.
Yeah.
I mean, on books, obviously, we can obviously you are regularly. I'm sure you have read everything by Taleb or Kahneman and Tversky, and I have a feeling that you know behavioral economics and behavioral finance is something you very closely follow. Probably you have read Richard Thaler as well. Which is the last interesting book that you went through?
So my approach towards books is that I have a huge collection of books, and I keep referring to them whenever I get some new thought, or I see something in the market which is happening according to that book. One very interesting book which I have just read is a book, obviously, Taleb has been a favorite, has been the favorite author. His book about skin in the game, his book called Skin in the Game.
Yeah.
This is about how the public policies need to be made, and what kind of incentives should be there for the people who are into government, who are making policies, what kind of incentive structure, what kind of maybe remuneration structure should be in place for them, and why they need to be held accountable. So that is one very interesting book which I've just read.
I'm saying, and the book is quite derogatory about bureaucrats, right? They don't have any skin in the game, isn't it?
So, but one criticism which I have of Taleb is that he thinks that he is the god or the master of the universe, being an option trader himself. He thinks that he knows everything. But at the ground, when you need to see, to just see from the perspective of a bureaucrat, his incentive and his worldview is not the same as the worldview of an option trader.
Yeah.
So these are two different worlds, and they will work and they will basically manifest themselves in their own way. You can't expect, like, let's say for an example, this whole pandemic response. So it is very easy for a person like Taleb, who is not in the government policy making team, to say that shut all the airports, shut all the entry points to the country. But no, this is not so easy. In hindsight, now we can see that, okay, why didn't they shut the airports, or why didn't they shut the ports in February itself? But sitting in February, it was so difficult to foresee how this pandemic would pan out. Maybe if it didn't pan out the way it did, we as a public would have said that, okay, this guy taking such an action. So it is very difficult sitting in a policy position and taking those calls vis-a-vis guys like us who are just commenting and who are having the benefit of hindsight.
Public policy, it's called public policy, and it's basically a public office is public by definition, right? You're accountable for what you're doing. And there's a lot of baggage which comes with your decisions. So, if you're an options trader or if you're a private person, when it comes to public policy issues, you don't have a skin in the game, right? I mean, as long as you're safe and you're living in your house. So, no, I completely understand what you mean there. In addition to Taleb, Skin in the Game, I think one book that you might find pretty interesting, because you are a staunch Keynesian, is Krugman's Arguing with Zombies. He kind of gives a very...
I've not read that, but I've followed Krugman for some time, his articles in the newspaper, but I've not read that book.
I mean, actually, he's an in-your-face Democrat, so he's being quite, you know, he's very clear, I think, through his writings, which side of the spectrum he supports. But I think still it's very smartly written. So, yeah, it's something you might enjoy.
Yes. And I'm looking forward to reading Mr. Urjit Patel's book.
Okay.
Due to be released now, I guess.
Right, yeah.
About the Indian banking system. So, there is one book which is there to be on my agenda right now.
Yeah.
So there you go. We have three strong recommendations,
we have,
right?
We have views, general views on the markets. We have some analysis on policy measures, and now we have we'll end with book recos. So that was a very fruitful, almost 55-minute long chat.
Yeah, it's been super interesting, and hope Abhijit, you also enjoyed as much as we did, and it's been great having you.
Yeah, that was a very interesting conversation, and the operating word about any conversation or any interaction which we need to have is interesting.
Yeah.
That's when it gets registered, and I hope that your listeners also take something out of it and find it interesting, and some thoughts get registered with them.
Yeah, no.
Now that I think I said interesting too many times.
Yeah, it was indeed interesting. But thank you so much for your time, Abhijit. Really appreciate it, okay?
Same for inviting me to your show.
Absolutely. And, you know, just one thing. I mean, I know you send your newsletter to a very, kind of selective lot of people. I mean, we included. So let's be happy about that. But, I mean, is there any kind of a subscription thing that you have? Like, in the sense that can anyone just access your newsletter and sign up for it? I mean, if there is, we'll be happy to share a link on our description as well. I don't know, like, how you go about it.
So there's no formal subscription policy which we have. If someone stumbles on that newsletter, if they want to have it in their inboxes on a daily basis, they can just write on that email ID on my email ID, and I'll add them to the list. So there's nothing formal about it.
Great. So what we'll do is we'll put our email IDs on our description and ask people to express their interest. If they are, then we'll pass it on to you.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Works with me.
All right.
No, we are very conscious about your privacy. So we are not going to disclose your email ID just like that.
Thanks for doing the concern.
Thanks a lot, Abhijit. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think we can wrap it up now. And I'm looking forward to our next guest as well. But more on that when we have that person.
Yeah.
Great. So this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off. Yeah.